I don't know if Harry remembers this, but it was 11 years ago that I spoke at this same program. A lot's changed in 11 years. George W. Bush was president. Spencer Bacchus was your congressman. And I didn't have a beard. I saw Harry between services this morning. He said, you are going to shave before tonight, aren't you? And I said, well, I've been informed by higher power that I'm not shaving my beard. And I happen to be married to her. So sorry, Harry. You understand. I made some notes, but we may go off script here a little bit because listening to the songs and watching those young people up here, I thought about what else has changed in 11 years. We're much more divided. We've got a crisis on our hands that I think we have to speak honestly to. We have to be willing to acknowledge. And the thing that bothers me most is that we so soon forget who we are. I had a meeting off on Capitol Hill, and I don't go out much. I don't have much of a social life. I don't have much of a personality. But I tell people I have one. It's just not very good. But I was at a meeting, and I walked back, and it was one of those crystal clear nights, and I was walking in front of the Supreme Court and got right in front of the Capitol. And it's rare that there's nobody there, but I looked there and there was nobody there. And you could see the stars behind the dome. And it's one of those times when it hits you where you are. And it just happened to be a day or two before the anniversary of D-Day. And it popped into my head this question. I wonder who was the first soldier to die that morning when those Higgins boats hit those beaches. I wonder what he was thinking. You know, he might have been 19, 20 years old. And you could hear those bullets hitting the ramp as they were approaching there, those engines churning, trying to get them as close as they could. And when the ramp came down, did his foot ever touch the surf? And I'm amazed. But what's even more amazing is that the guy behind him kept going, and the guy behind him, and the guy beside him, not knowing how that day might end for them, and for most of them it was the last day, but still committed to the cause that they were willing to give their lives for. And I think about that, about how precious that gift was that they laid on the altar of freedom, and how it's rare that we really appreciate it, and how there's maybe a whole generation, maybe two generations or more, that don't have that deep sense of obligation and responsibility that we should all feel for every one of those who gave, as Lincoln said, the last full measure of devotion. And so I'm an amateur historian. I have a real sense of what is happening right now in this country. And I think back to something that I read that David McCullough had written about a meeting that Ralph Waldo Emerson had with John Adams in 1825. Adams was 90 years old. And Adams made this comment. He said, "I would that Americans had more ambition." He said, by that I mean ambition of the laudable kind, to excel. And I had to ask myself, that's 49 years after the Declaration of Independence. What did he see that was lacking in the American people at that time that he would say that? You know, I wonder what he would say about us today, 243 years later. Adams was one of the key founders, he and Thomas Jefferson. Now, I take people on tours of the Capitol at night, and I like to take them into the rotunda. And there's four paintings on the eastern side of the rotunda. There's four on the west, and the first one on the west side is the painting of John Trumbull's painting of the Declaration, the signing of the Declaration. And if you've ever seen that painting, look closely, you'll see that Jefferson is standing on Adams' toe. Tom Trumbull wrote that. He was a contemporary. He knew both these men. And he painted it that way because toward the end of their lives, after Jefferson had defeated Adams in the third presidential election, or fourth presidential election, Washington served two terms, they became bitter enemies. They were estranged for years. And finally, Dr. Benjamin Rush got them together toward the end of their lives, and they restored that friendship. And it and their letters that they exchanged are amazing. But the thing that pulled them apart that amazes me is their differences of opinion about how this republic should evolve. And it's a miracle. Not only that we defeated the British to gain our independence, but that we survived the first 30 years as divided as we were then. Adams had gotten to the point where he thought that we ought to have a monarchy because he didn't think we were capable of self-government without a permanent monarchy, a permanent Senate. Jefferson, on the other hand, was enthralled with the French Revolution, even as bloody as it was. He thought it was worth it. But they both came together at the end. And on July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day of the announcement of the Declaration of Independence, John Adams, on his deathbed, said, "Jefferson still survives." And he passed away. Those were his last words. What he didn't know was that Jefferson had died 5 hours earlier. Isn't it amazing in God's providence that these two men who are so much the principles behind our Declaration and defining what our country would be would die the same day, 50 years to the day that the Declaration was announced? I think about that, and I think about the questions that we ought to be asking ourselves today about what kind of nation we need to be, what kind of people we need to be, and do we still have the capacity to govern ourselves? I think about something that former Governor Richard Lamb of Colorado, a Democrat, had written years ago in a magazine called Chronicles. He said that great nations need great citizens because our Constitution, no matter how the genius behind it, how well it's written, will not govern a people that have lost the ability to care. And I wonder about that as I go to work every week and think about what we've lost. How many of you saw the Cathedral of Notre Dame as it burned? It was on TV. I watched it as it burned. I literally began to pray that they'd be able to put it out, Harry, because I began to realize that we weren't just about to lose a building. We're about to lose something that's irreplaceable. Europe has become basically an agnostic, if not atheistic, nation. And Notre Dame was a symbol of what Europe was and what I think Europe could be if God, in His mercy and grace, were to bring about a great awakening, a great revival, as you spoke about in the early 1700s, that gave birth to this nation, could give a new birth to Europe. And as I watched that structure burn, and as I prayed that they would be able to put it out, it hit me that there are some things that are irreplaceable. Things that we don't want to lose. I was in you might be surprised to know this, there's Bible studies every week in Congress. I attend a couple. One is a group of us meet in our offices. We rotate each around our offices. When it's in my office, I lead it. And there's another one that's led by a guy named Ralph Drollinger, who was the starting center on John Wooden's last national championship at UCLA. 7'2", you can't miss him. And these are going on all the time. And in one of our Bible studies, we had a guest speaker come in. Some of you may know him. Rick Scarborough came in, and during his lesson, he made this statement. He said, talking about those of us who are members of Congress, he said, "You're the best of the best, the cream of the crop." And I immediately had a check in my spirit. I couldn't agree with that. So when we wrapped it up and people were making comments, I told Rick, I said, I need to take exception to that statement that we're the best of the best and the cream of the crop, because I'm certain out of 325 million people, maybe just in this audience, there are people who are smarter and maybe more capable than us. I'm not saying that about every single member, but when you think about it, I said, so I wouldn't say we're the best of the best. I wouldn't say we're the cream of the crop. We're the willing. And that's the thing that I think about as we go into elections, and it's not a political speech, but just in general, who are we sending to represent us, whether it's city council, county commissioner, the state legislature, governor, president, Congress? And how many are willing? How many are willing to put themselves up to run for office? My sister-in-law's here. She checks my Facebook page. I don't. I used to have a personal Facebook page. I shut it down because I got tired of my wife and me seeing the comments that people send in. And they're not very good. And we were on vacation together, and she brought up one comment that somebody sent in, and she asked me if I'd sent it, and I hadn't. But I got to thinking about, why do people do that? And I pretty much decided there's two groups that do it. There's one group that I think are sincerely distressed about the condition of the country and where we're going. And I think they express it through social media because they don't feel like they've got any other outlet. These are people that I think are seriously struggling with hope for our future. Then there's another group. And these are what I would call the paid assassins. They're there to say all kind of evil about you. Most of it untrue. I'd say 99% is untrue. And they're not really directing it to me or any of my colleagues. They're directing it to you. Because they want to make sure that none of you would ever dare step up to the line and run for an office. And you got to understand whether it's a representative republic or any other form of government, it's about one thing. It's about power. And I think that's most of the people we're dealing with are those who are doing character assassinations through social media so that you have no confidence in the people who represent you, so that you will not support anybody who runs for office because you have no confidence in anyone who would run for office, and so that you will never, ever consider running for office yourself. And I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that is incredibly destructive of our representative republic. I didn't want to run for Congress. When Spencer Backus was in office, I had people tell me, you know, you should run, and I really didn't want to. But I kept getting encouragement, so I did what I think we all should do when you're getting a message like that. I think you pray about it. And I went in my closet. Ann was already in bed. I went in my closet, prayed about it. And I don't recommend starting prayers like I started this one, but I said, God, I really don't want to go to Congress. And I don't want to live in Washington. But I'll go where you want me to go and do what you want me to do. I didn't want to quit my job in engineering to start the Alabama Policy Institute, but this has worked out. So if this is what you want me to do, give me a sign. And got up the next morning, was shaving, got a text message. Finished shaving, went over and checked the text message, and the message was Spencer Backus just announced he's retiring. The Lord works pretty quick sometimes. And initially I said I would, and then I went to Washington, spent about 3 days. I was up there working on some stuff. I flew home on a Friday morning. And I was having my Jonah moment, Harry. I wasn't waiting for y'all to throw me off the boat. I was getting off the boat. And I came home, told our managing chairman, Tom Bradford Jr., that I wasn't going to run. He was not happy about it. Wanted me to take the weekend, pray about it. The end of the day, went home, sat down at the kitchen table with Ann and told her that I wasn't going to run. I thought she'd be relieved because she's never wanted to be a part of politics. She doesn't like for anybody to ask her to stand up. You'll find out later. But I told her I wasn't going to run. She looked at me and she said, you know what? I've heard you say for years what's wrong with the country is you can't get good people to run. She said, I've even heard you. Compare it to going to war. Well, I can tell you it's not like those guys that hit that shore, but it is a sacrifice. And she said, how can you expect somebody else to go if you won't? She said, I know this is not what we want, but I think it's not about what we want. I think it's about what we're supposed to do, and I think we're supposed to do this. I knew I had to do it. And I knew I'd win. So that's the challenge that I think we face. We've got to have people willing to be confronted by what the real need is, and the real need is godly people in places of influence. And it's not just in politics. It's in the pulpit. It's in the principal's office. It's in corporate America. It's in the operating room. It's in the banks and the universities. We have to be that leaven that leavens the whole loaf if we want to get our country back on the right track. So, great nations need great citizens. We've gone through a period of decline. I spoke to a group of juniors and seniors at Birmingham Southern College back in 2008. Oddly enough, the same year I spoke here. And these were all religion and political science majors. You know, they were honors college students, supposedly the best of the best. And I asked them how many of them had ever heard of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And they're all looking around. And the professor says, come on. And one of them says, well, wasn't he on the cover of The Economist a couple of months ago? And I said, yeah, he just died. And she said, maybe they're not as well educated as I thought. I didn't say it, but I thought precisely. But the reason I brought that up was it was 30 years prior that Solzhenitsyn had given the commencement address at Harvard entitled A World Split Apart. And he made this comment. And for those of you who are not familiar with Solzhenitsyn, he was a Christian, a great writer. He wrote the Gulag Archipelago. He was a Soviet dissident. He'd been held in the Gulag. That book had been slipped out of the Soviet Union and published in the West. And it forced so much attention on the Soviets, they had to let him go, and he was sent to the United States basically in exile. And so he made this comment. He said, were I asked, would I recommend the West as a model for our people, meaning the people of Russia? He said, I would have to answer negatively. He said, the West in its current state of spiritual exhaustion holds no attraction to us. The interesting thing is what happened over the next 10 or 11 years that I'm not sure Solzhenitsyn ever anticipated. And I said I take people on tours of the Capitol at night. And I had 70 high school students there a couple of weeks ago, all from Alabama. And I took them over to the statue of Ronald Reagan. And I told them, you know, everybody I think has a sense that things are a little bit tense in Washington right now. And I told them, I said, you know, this is not the first time this country's faced a crisis. We've faced crisis before. We've gone through some really tough times. We're an amazingly resilient people. I said 1979 was one of those times. In 1979, we had double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation. Our consumer interest rates were double-digit. They hit 21% in the spring of 1980. The Soviets had troops in Central America and the Caribbean, Central Africa. They invaded Afghanistan that year. There were 52 Americans being held hostage in our embassy in Tehran. Conservative and liberal alike thought the Soviets would win the Cold War. But what I want to point out is that's not all that was happening in 1979. In May of 79, Margaret Thatcher was elected Prime Minister of Great Britain. In 1979, Ronald Reagan was running for president, talking about how he would rebuild our economy and how he would defeat the Soviet Union. He even said that they would be on the ash heap of history. But in June of 1979, Pope John Paul II went back to Poland, his native country. When he first announced that he was going back, the KGB, the Soviet secret police, considered having him assassinated, but instead, they pumped atheism into the Polish school system for weeks ahead of his visit. They muzzled the Polish media to try to limit the number of people that would know that he was coming. But when the motorcade took him from the airport into the old city of Warsaw, there were a million people lining the streets chanting, "We want God." And what I tell those 70 high school students is that light will always pierce the darkness. Always. About 6 days later, he held a mass outside the ancient city of Krakow in a place called Blonny Field. It had been raining for 2 or 3 days, so it was a muddy mess. And they estimate that between 2.5 and 3 million people gathered to hear that mass. And at the end of it, he said this. He said, "Love is stronger than death. Faith is stronger than death. Do not despair. Do not be discouraged. Do not be defeated." That was June of 1979. When Pope John Paul II died, Peggy Noonan wrote a beautiful eulogy. It was in the Wall Street Journal, and she said that homily, that statement at the end, many historians believe that it became inevitable that the Soviet Union would collapse. But here's the rest of the story. Almost 8 years to the day, in June of 1987, President Ronald Reagan stood outside the Brandenburg Gate and said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And 17 months later, it was down. Now, Bruce, if any one of us had gone anywhere in the United States in 1979 and said, "In 10 years, we will have gone through the greatest economic expansion the world's ever seen, and the Iron Curtain will be down, and the Soviet Union will be coming apart," people would have thought we were crazy. But the whole world was changing. And most of us missed it. I believe we're in one of those moments. The last major speech that President Reagan gave was in 1992 in Houston at the Republican National Convention. And at the end of that speech, he quoted a guy named James Allen, who had written in his diary that most thinking people believe America's seen her best days. Mr. Allen wrote that July 26, 1775. The whole world was changing. Mr. Allen missed it. So what I tell those high school students as they were looking at that statue is that you're standing under the dome of the most powerful nation in the history of the world. History is being made. Don't miss it. Be a part of it. Now I'm gathering them up a little bit closer because the statue stands on a granite pedestal. It's kind of a beige color except for a strip about this wide that's kind of greenish gray that runs around near the top. That's the Berlin Wall. How appropriate that the guys who stood and challenged Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down that wall, his statue stands on part of the wall. So I told them that to let them know that there's hope. Where the Spirit of God is, where people are willing to sacrifice, to give of themselves, put others, the interest of others before their own, to live out the admonition in Philippians 2, 3 through 8, great things can happen. We've seen it before. I asked Bruce how long I had. He said, "I could go as long as I want to, but I'm not going to do that." And I got an amen on that. I want to challenge the church. I feel like the church has failed. It's failed not necessarily in proclaiming the gospel, but making the gospel relevant to where we are today. And challenging people to live as Christ would have us live. We've gotten caught up in material things, but I can tell you, if you look at the suicide rate and the drug overdose death rate, the other issues that we're dealing with, it should be very evident that material blessings will never satisfy the longings of the soul. They don't make for great community. They don't make for great nations. There's a Roman historian named Livy who said that, well, luxury is more ruthless than war. Well, war will kill the body. But worship of wealth and luxury will kill the soul. I think we failed in preparing our children to lead. And I was thrilled to see these young people up here and to see young people in the audience tonight, because I want to tell you, and I can tell you this with absolute certainty, you're going to lead one day. There's no question about it. I appreciate the young men are up here for the presentation of the colors. And I can tell you that they're going to lead, because they're going to wake up one morning and the folks my age and some of your ages are not going to be here. And it's going to be left to them. So I think each one of us should have a real sense of responsibility, a real sense of obligation. I have this to prepare them for when that day comes, because that day will come. I think we need to be doing it right now, preparing people to take our places. When we leave the places of office, Harry's going to retire one day. There needs to be someone prepared for that. And I know he's invested in it, because I know what he's doing at the seminary in Philadelphia. I know that he understands the connection between faith and practice, and that practice applied to every sphere of our country, whether it's the pulpit or the speaker's podium in the United States House of Representatives. We've got to do a better job. We've also got to do a better job of emphasizing that freedom depends on virtue. Oz Guinness has developed this little formula, and he says that freedom depends on virtue, and virtue depends on religion, and religion depends on freedom. I don't think there's ever been a time in the history of the United States when our faith has been under such vigorous attack. This church has experienced some of it. There's social media attacks on that as well. Freedom depends on virtue. John Adams said it, our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. Freedom depends on virtue. Virtue depends on religion, and religion depends on freedom. You've got to have those together. We've got to have faith in one another. And this is what I see on a regular basis within the House of Representatives, working on legislation that most of us would think that we would all be behind, but we are so divided because we no longer have faith in each other. I try to address that. This is summarize it like this. If we are to maintain a representative American republic, we must have faith in each other's purpose and hope in each other's future, and in charity toward each other's shortcomings. There is no forgiveness in this country anymore. Have you thought about that? And our whole faith, the whole basis of what we believe, hinges on the hope and the promise that our sins have been removed as far as the east is from the west. That we not only are forgiven by our God through the blood of Jesus Christ, but we have the ability to forgive others. Because we see each one and our own fallen state of humanity. But we're losing that. I want to read something to you. I promised Dan I wouldn't read a speech, but I need to read this. It says, no material progress, even though it takes shapes we cannot conceive, or however it may expand the faculties of man, can bring comfort to his soul. It is this fact, more wonderful than any that science can reveal, which gives the best hope that all will be well. Projects undreamed of by past generations will absorb our immediate descendants. Forces terrific and devastating will be in their hands. Comforts, activities, amenities, pleasures will crowd upon them, but their hearts will ache. Their lives will be barren if they have not a vision above material things. And with the hopes and powers will come dangers out of all proportion to the growth of man's intellect, to the strength of his character, or to the efficacy of his institutions. Once more, the choice is offered between blessing and cursing. Never was the answer that will be given harder to foretell. That was Winston Churchill, December 1931. It's prophetic. We still have that choice between blessing and cursing. It's a choice that we must make while we still have the power to choose between blessing and cursing. And whether you realize it or not, you're making that choice. How you use your time, how you spend your resources, and how much you're willing to put into your church, your community, and your country. As I said, we are a resilient people. We're an amazing people. We're a people of hope, capable of great things, able to endure and persist and prevail over all of our difficulties. That's our history. Our history is not a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's about failures and successes. It's about learning what worked and what didn't work. It's being smart enough not to repeat the mistakes of the past and willing to try the things that will make us better people. On the eastern side of the House of Representatives, there's a mural. And it's a painting of the signing of the Constitution. The guy signing is from North Carolina. The guy behind him is from North Carolina. And the guy behind him is from North Carolina. I have no idea why, other than the artist might have been from North Carolina. At least maybe his wife was. But behind the desk is President George Washington presiding over the convention. And right prominent, right in the middle of the painting, is Benjamin Franklin looking out at the people viewing the painting. He's sitting in a chair and he's got a cane in his hand. And I look at that, and I like to do this with members of Congress as well as the people that I have with me on some of these tours, and I point to the chair that sits behind Washington. It's called the Sunburst Chair. If you were to go to Philadelphia and go to Independence Hall, you could see that chair. It sits in the very room where Washington presided. And Franklin made this observation. He said, "I've often looked at that chair during these deliberations and asked myself, is that sun rising or is that sun setting?" And he said, "I concluded that it's a rising sun." And what I like to say to my fellow members, and what I say to you tonight, is whether that sun continues to rise or not is entirely up to us. So I encourage you, hold firm to your faith, persist, prevail, engage in the struggle, make that choice. As I pray that God will guide us in all the choices that we have to make, because our future depends on it. God bless you.